You are listening to the cycling podcast at the 2023 Tour de France. Today, we're in Courchevel.
If we thought the race for the yellow jersey was over this time yesterday, well, it certainly is tonight, isn't it? Jonas Vingegaard has put the Maillot Jaune beyond doubt. And as we sit here with the sun setting behind the mountains and the air gradually going cool, it feels like the Dane is pretty much guaranteed to clinch his second consecutive Tour de France in Paris on Sunday. We will talk all about that in this episode of the Cycling Podcast from the Tour de France. It was stage 17 today. My name is Lionel Burney, and again, I'm with Richard Abraham, whose work you may well have seen in Rouleur and other places. Welcome, Richard. Your first kind of proper day back on the Tour de France. I know I say that, yesterday you were here in full, but it was a time trial day. It doesn't kind of feel quite the same, but today was proper mountains, wasn't it?
It was proper mountains, and it was proper big mountains as well. We're really high up, 2,000 metres, 2,300 or something on the top. And it's just the Tour de France. It's that sort of classic image of a tour, isn't it? Big mountains, all the key riders fighting it out, lots of fans on the roadside, helicopters in the sky. Like, it's, yeah.
Huge crowds as well, which we will talk about a little bit later. I should set the scene. We are here surrounded by the mountains, and camper vans are parked in the car park, Tour de France fans. And Richard has got some kind of flying insect on his forehead there. Oh, it's. Well, I think it got away. We are sitting at the bottom of a little ski lift, which in the wintertime will take people up to come down this. Quite a gentle run, this one, isn't it? I think I'd fancy
green,
my chances.
Green or blue? Maybe blue in places. Not very steep.
I could cope with that. Yeah. I could cope with that. I'm no skier, I should say. Well, let's get on with the business of the day, because it was a dramatic stage.
It's time for the tale of the attack.
Stage 17 from Saint-Gervais-Mont-Blanc to Courchevel, 165.7 kilometres up and down all day with some big, big mountains. And the attacks were going right from the start, because lots of riders wanted to be in the big break. And it went clear eventually on the Col de Saisy. But one of the first things we heard was that Tadej Pogacar, who was dealt that blow in the time trial yesterday, had a shocking start to the morning, because he was on the ground early on after a small crash. So not the ideal start for him, as he was hoping to get back into the picture, as difficult as that might have looked this morning for him. The break went, and it went kind of true to form, really. Jumbo-Visma put two riders in it. UAE Team Emirates put two riders in it. There were lots of riders hoping that it might go their way and they would bag a stage win. The likes of Valentin Madouas, Thibaut Pinot, Rigoberto Urán was in there, Julian Alaphilippe, Jack Haig, Giulio Ciccone, who was chasing mountains points, and Rui Costa, Guillaume Martin. Lots of names that we've seen up the road already in the mountain stages, but crucially, it was Félix Gall of AG2R and Simon Yates of Jayco Alula. Now, Jayco put three riders in there, and, well, they were chasing the stage. But it all broke down on the climb of the Col de la Loze, and Félix Gall of AG2R really seized his moment. He had his big breakthrough win a month ago at the Tour de Suisse when he won a mountain stage there. And he's been freed up in this tour because Ben O'Connor has been out of the overall picture since very early on, and he really seized his moment despite a spirited chase from Simon Yates in the final kilometres. I was wondering whether the steep climb up to the Altiport at Courchevel might catch Gall out, but no, he had enough in the tank to win the stage. A very impressive one for him. But it was all about the battle between Jonas Vingegaard and Tadej Pogacar today. And, well, the wind really has gone out of Pogacar's sails, hasn't it? He was struggling very early on the climb of the Col de la Loze. And really, it wasn't in a phase of the race where Jumbo-Visma were really piling the pressure on him. He just kind of went backwards, lost contact, had only one teammate, Marc Soler, for company. And so he has lost a lot of time and now lies 7 minutes 35 behind Jonas Vingegaard. If there is a glimmer of good fortune for UAE Team Emirates, it's that Adam Yates has kind of cemented his place in third place. So he looks like he may well take the podium position. A lot could happen on Saturday, of course, but he is 1 minute 16 ahead of Carlos Rodriguez. And then a real shuffling in the bottom half of the top 10. Simon Yates not winning the stage, but he has jumped up three places to fifth overall. Pao Bilbao has also moved up one to sixth. Jai Hindley's dropped down two places to seventh, and Félix Gall, who's been yo-yoing in and out of the top 10, now looks a good bet to finish in that top 10 in Paris because he is up to eighth. The King of the Mountains race really hotted up as well. Giulio Ciccone made it his mission to get as many points as possible, and he won the first three climbs, and he has the lead in the Polkadot jersey competition with 88 points. Gall is only six behind with 82, and ominously, Vingegaard is 1 point behind Gall, so that will all be decided on Saturday. We did lose a couple of riders as well. Alexis Reynard was a non-starter. Now, he crashed and fractured a bone yesterday, and Richard, we think, finished 1 second outside the time limit.
He broke his elbow, according to L'Equipe, and I can't imagine doing a time trial, even on a road bike, with a broken elbow. So, well done, Alexi, in actually finishing, but it sounds like the... It probably was the right decision not to carry on with the broken elbow.
He's not out because he finished 1 second outside the time cut. I would have thought if his injury is permitted, he would have been allowed by the race jury to carry on. One non-finisher, Phil Bauhaus of Bahrain Victorious, who was in the hunt for sprint stages early in the tour, but that's one less sprinter to contest the remaining flatter stages. And we will discuss that in the final part. A big thank you to MAP, the Melbourne-based cycling clothing company, who have been sponsoring the Cycling Podcast since the beginning of last year and have produced our fantastic jersey, which is available at map.cc. We've been hearing from Jared Smith, one of the co-founders and co-owners of MAP, about Melbourne cycling culture.
G'day, this is Jared from MAP, and I'm the co-founder and the co-CEO. And yeah, been doing this for 10 years now. The scene in Melbourne for cycling is pretty prevalent at the moment. It's really taken off, and I've been doing it for about 20 years. And in that time, it's really come a long way, and we've got a really great crit scene, and we've got many local clubs and teams, and it's most weekends you can go down and catch a local race or you choose to go for a ride out in the hills. We've got plenty of hill rides, and we also have a very popular ride on Beach Road, which we see hundreds of people there daily riding up and down Beach Road. So the scene here, it's really embracing cycling, and we also have quite a big growing gravel scene, which is getting bigger and bigger as well. So yeah, it's just a really vibrant scene at the moment.
Go to map.cc. all of their clothing beautifully photographed on the website gives a really good impression of how it will look on the body. That's map.cc. Now, Richard, that stage win for Félix Gall, it's kind of been coming. He's been in breaks throughout the tour, really, whenever the opportunity has presented itself. He has an eye-catching performance at the Tour de Suisse. And as I said, with Ben O'Connor having fallen out of the GC picture very early, it's given Gall, riding his first Tour de France, opportunities. And today he really took that opportunity and he seized the initiative, went up the road and made it a chase.
That's right. And I mean, he doesn't look like the sort of rider that you'd think would excel on the kind of climb that the Col de la Loze is. Lots of changes in gradient. You'd think it would suit. Well, it was Miguel Angel Lopez who won the stage in 2020, who is about as pure as the pure climbers get, isn't he? Very small, very sort of punchy, accelerated rider. Félix Gall just calmly churned away at that climb, and despite the best efforts of Simon Yates, who does sort of fit that more climber mould, Yates never really got close, did he? He was sort of yo-yoing between sort of 20, 30 seconds, but it never looked like that was under much threat. And even on that finish, you could easily have made up 20 seconds with fresh legs on somebody on that brutal finish on the Altiport. I don't know what the percentage was there, but very steep. I was quite out of breath having walked up half of that on the way to the finish line. One of those roads that, yeah, it's steep to walk up as well as to ride up, but rode exceptionally well to take the stage win. And he's been a presence in this tour, hasn't he? He's been in that selection on the final climb on a number of occasions, just not necessarily dictating affairs in the same way that UAE and Jumbo-Visma have, but that's not his place to. He doesn't have the teammates, he doesn't have the pedigree, And yeah, he's rode a fantastic debut tour. And I think certainly, like you mentioned, Lionel, the fact that Ben O'Connor dropped out of contention fairly early on, that's actually been such a great kind of a saving grace for Ajay Desert, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when you think back to the Pyrenees and stage five, which was the first real kind of mountain stage, the one that Jai Hindley won where he took the yellow jersey, Ciccone was second. We thought then he might be targeting the polka dot jersey, and lo and behold, here he is with the jersey with a few days to go. And Felix Gal with third on that stage. But as you say, it's just that hovering in and around. You know, he wasn't too far away the next day at Corte Cambas. He was 15th there. He was kind of second or maybe front of the third group on Le Puy de Dôme. And then he's had a solid few days. The Grand Colombier, he was good, and seventh on the stage to Morzine as well. So it has kind of been coming. And like I say, that race today, because of the severity of the final climb and, you know, not just the ramp up to the line, I mean, the severity of the top part of the Col de la Loze and the descent as well, it was one of those stages where it kind of had to be done by the top before the plummet down on the very tricky descent, which we will talk about a little bit later. But he got himself out there and made himself very hard to chase. And Simon Yates is, you know, he's the sort of rider that you would probably bet on to close a gap like that. And he did get very close in terms of seconds. But of course, on those steep gradients, you know, 15 seconds is a lot of actual physical ground to make up.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that the nature of the Col de la Loze as well is that all the riders are just on their limit at that point. It's not the sort of thing that you can almost ride tactically. It's so steep when it is steep that they're riding flat out to keep going, and then any recovery they can get on the easier sections, I mean, they're just trying to do that. So it's not the sort of typical alpine climb that could be raced tactically in that sense, really. It's just too hard for tactics to come into play.
At the finish, Richard, you were there when Simon Yates came over the line, and let's hear what he had to say.
Yeah, we really wanted to try and go after the stage today, and all the guys have been extremely fantastic. Put Lawson Craddock there driving the breakaway all day, and then Chris Harper to raise the pace and pace me in the final, and both guys did a spectacular job, so chapeau to them.
Simon, just coming up the Col de la Loze, did you have in your mind when you wanted to go, or were you thinking very much about Vingegaard coming from behind and the favourites coming from behind?
Bit of both. I think you never know how fast those guys come from behind, so that was always in the back of my mind, and the rest of the guys. Chris did a fantastic job in the final part of the climb when they really started to raise the pace from behind, and I mean, I didn't know the climb. I don't know if I changed anything, but I was very wary of the altitude, so I tried to pace myself and then go from there.
And you waited a long time after that brilliant first day here for this opportunity. Did you have the legs that you would have wanted to have when the opportunity did present itself?
No, I think I've done a good ride. And like I said to somebody else, chapeau to Felix Gall there. Great ride by him. And like I said, I'm pretty happy with my ride. It's a shame it couldn't be a win, but that's how it goes.
And you've moved up a bit on GC, a bit of a crumb of comfort.
Yeah, I wasn't really looking for that today, though. I think, I don't even know, I'm behind 15 minutes almost, so we're pretty irrelevant now.
At the team buses, I also spoke to Matt Heyman, sports director for Jayco Alula, who is in the second team car, which means that he went up to follow the breakaway and was behind Simon Yates all day. And this is what he had to say about Jayco Alula's third second place during this tour. Well, second place and a real pursuit on the run in there. What was the story of the day from your point of view? Was there anything that Simon could have done slightly differently to have been closer to Gal at the end?
Look, I don't know. I'd have to talk to Simon. I haven't seen him since the race. You know, he was well supported today. I mean, hats off to the team from the start of the day today. I couldn't have asked more from them. You know, we decided we want to throw the kitchen sink at today's stage and see where we ended up. And if we lost time, we lost time. You know, it's bittersweet because we were really going after the stage win as much as anything. And but yeah, look, that last climb is brutal. Simon knows his body, and I'm sure he rode to his limits. And if someone's better, then someone's better.
no mean feat to just get in a break like that when you're that high on GC, though. So what was the strategy this morning?
Oh, look, we just knew we needed numbers too. It's no point him being there by himself. You know, we tested the waters. It didn't seem like Jumbo wanted to let it go. You're never really sure what their tactics are sometimes. They were holding it there for a long time. But, yeah, eventually got out to around the three-minute mark. They had two riders there. I think they were a lot more comfortable once Tish Benoit and Kelderman came across. And then, yeah, I guess, you know, I haven't followed up. I saw something about 6 minutes for Podrico. I don't know where everybody is yet. And I saw once that happened that the guys were going back from the front group instead of going after the stage. There's so many things at play, you know. You need to keep an eye on Mountains joint. We knew that Ciccone would be going for that, and not only him, his whole team. There's Teams GC up for stake. So, yeah, it's quite a, you know, you've got to be on top of it all.
Well, there's a lot of riders in there, as you say, a lot of different objectives, and only one Simon Yates, who's your card to play for the stage win. So it's quite complicated, isn't it?
If it had really blown out and we had Chris Harper there, I would have been happy to let him go to the line. I mean, he wasn't bad. I think he's top 10 on the stage today. I mean, he can get up a climb like that. And he did a fabulous job again today for Simon. Bittersweet that, you know, that's the second place we've had in this tour. But I can't knock the boys at all. Every time we get out there, they give it their all.
3 second places then for Jayco Alula, but I guess the difficulty was getting in the break in the first place, because well placed overall, the second highest placed rider overall in that 31-man group, Simon Yates, Peo Bilbao just ahead. So that was probably contributing to the break not going out to a significant advantage at any point during the day. And with Chris Harper in there as well, who's been shadowing Simon Yates throughout this tour and is a good climber in his own right, they did have a couple of cards to play, but in that situation you would bet on Simon Yates being the most likely one to close it out, but coming up just short. I did ask, you know, what could they have done differently, but very, very difficult in a stage like that. As you say, Richard, it's about getting up the road and just holding on as much as anything.
That's right. I mean, I don't think Simon was ever really going for the GC manoeuvre there. It was all about the stage win, as I think he said when he crossed the line. And yeah, Simon's had a pretty good tour, actually. 2 second places.
I suppose if there is a downside, Simon Yates is now fifth on GC, so he's even more of a threat. Okay, still 12 minutes 19 behind, so he's not going to be worrying Jumbo-Visma, but it might make it more complicated for him if he has his eyes on Saturday's stage to Le Markstein. We will have to wait and see. Well, we got down from the finish up in Courchevel, and I think it's time to learn a bit more about the area from our very good friend François Thomazeau.
Now for some French flavour with B, François Thomazeau.
Right, here you are, guys. I suppose you're in Courchevel, one of the poshest ski resorts in France, actually, with a number of Michelin star restaurants. I'm not sure you'll be eating there tonight. Anyway, it's the first time the Tour de France is back in Courchevel since 2005, when who won the stage that day? Well, you'll know if you listen to the Friends of the Podcast episode on Alejandro Valverde, because it's our newly retired Spanish friend who won there in 2005. Courchevel is a ski resort that was created between 1946 and 1950 from scratch, actually. The project began in 1946 when the commune of Saint-Bon, which is just down the valley, handed over the necessary land to the general council. And the initial work was carried out with great difficulty, with materials having to be transported by mule and men, such as the wooden poles for the Tovey and Loz ski lifts. And so they had to wait for 1946 and 1948 for the first hotel to open, called Les Trois Vallées, the Three Valleys. And some of the guys were used to bring equipment and material to build the hotel were actually German prisoners of war. And the resort was first accessed by car in 1948. Well, now just a little bit about Col de la Loze, we were back there. I mean, we were there before. I mean, it's not obviously the first time that the Tour de France had gone to Col de la Loze. It was actually opened in 2019. It was created by the ski resorts of Méribel and Courchevel, who decided to open a pass close to motorized traffic and dedicated to road bikes. And it links the valleys of Beauzelle and Les Alus at an altitude of 2,304 meters, which makes it the seventh highest pass in France and the third highest in Savoy, after the Isoran and Galibier. Before 2019, Col de la Loze was a ski slope, as I said, in winter, and a mountain bike trail in the summer. So today, remember in 2020, when the Tour de France first came to the Col de la Loze, the stage was won by Miguel Angel Lopez, while Primoz Roglic dropped Tadej Pogacar in the finale. So Tadej Pogacar never had any luck, on Col de la Loze, even though he had better memories of Méribel, as he won a stage in the Tour de l'Avenir there in 2015. And to finish, to wrap it up, you must remember the Tour de l'Avenir was the first race on which the Col de la Loze was used. And it was actually the whole of the 23.5 kilometers, eighth stage of the 2019 Tour de l'Avenir. And it was won by Australian Alexander Evans.
The cycling podcast at the 2023 Tour de France is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the cycling podcast. Now, the Tour de France is one of the most grueling physical tests the human body can undergo. It barely needs stating. Science in Sport's Go Isotonic Energy Gels are scientifically formulated to help riders maintain their pace for longer. So while you're going through hell, Science in Sport have got something to keep you going. Developed for elite athletes, but available to all. Fueled by science. Go to scienceinsport.com for the full range. Now, I think, well, we're being devoured here. I don't know what nutrition is in our blood, but the midges and mosquitoes or whatever they are.
Oh. The red-flavoured gels tonight, aren't they?
Yeah.
We should perhaps explain what pushed us here. We've been driven into the field, more or less, by... Not the finest cover band that I've heard.
No. I've been followed around France by a Coldplay covers band, it feels like. There was a couple last week, and when we arrived here at the bar we were hoping to record at, he was belting out Yellow, maybe a Jonas Vingegaard fan, I don't know.
Yeah.
But we should talk about the GC battle, because we had the sense last night that Tadej Pogacar was cracking, and we were perhaps thinking that maybe UAE Team Emirates would lay it all down and really try and recover the losses, but it just didn't materialise at all, did it? Pogacar never looked comfortable, and before we knew it, he was drifting backwards before really the key part of the climb had been approached.
He was just never... Yeah, like you said, Lionel, never in it. UAE and Jumbo kind of shaped up for something to happen, because they both put two riders in the breakaway. And indeed, what did happen was that when Jonas Vingegaard finally did basically ride away from the rest of the GC contenders quite a while after Pogacar had dropped back, you know, he caught up with his Jumbo-Visma teammates, Thijs Benoot and Wilco Kelderman. He almost didn't really need to by that point. He was... you know, head and shoulders above the rest of his contenders, and he knew at that point that Pogacar was way off the back. We know that he's not necessarily a rider who goes that well in the heat. It's something that's been discussed before as maybe one of his sort of weaker areas, and
the higher altitude as well he struggled with. I mean, the Col du Granon last year was his Achilles heel, wasn't it?
That's right. And I mean, he referred to that afterwards when he was after the stage. He said that today was a lot worse than the Col de Granon, and I mean, that's evident in just the amount of time that he lost. But equally, he was never in the fight like he was on the Granon. It wasn't that he was up there and got dropped by the better contender. He just pretty much from the start of the climb proper, with what, 14k to go or something like that. Jersey was open, flapping. Teammates was there, and it was, you know, it was on the radio basically. Game over for me. Look after your podium, Adam, and Adam Yates had that whole climb to ride for himself and protect his third place.
And Pogacar also said that at one point he thought maybe his podium place was slipping away, so that indicates how badly he was feeling on the climb. And we've never seen Tadej Pogacar look like this, have we? This is two really bad days back to back. And obviously the speculation will be, is it because of the far from ideal preparation, the wrist break at Liège-Bastogne-Liège and the time off the bike and then very little racing and not ideal? I mean, he put a brave face on it. You know, he smiled his way through his recovery, came into the Tour. You know, he had that setback at the very start when Vingegaard took the time on the first of the mountain stages, but then he struck back and it did look like he was chipping away. But still in the back of my mind is this confidence from Vingegaard that this would be a Tour of minutes and not seconds. And now it's looking like the sort of time gaps that we used to see sort of 20, 25 years ago.
That's right. Well, ignoring the 7 years of that officially been scrubbed from the records, for a time gap of 7 minutes between first and second on the GC, you have to go back to 2014 and Vincenzo Nibali. And was that Jean-Christophe Pérot or Thibaut Pinot?
Jean-Christophe Pérot was on the podium.
Yeah. And then back to 1997 and Jan Ullrich when he beat Richard Virenque. And it could be even more. If Pogacar doesn't come around, Vingegaard and Jumbo-Visma don't strike me as the sort of team that are going to go easy on that final mountain stage on Saturday. You know, they'll do what Jumbo do and they'll ride it as they ride it. And, you know, there's Vingegaard hasn't got that that mountain stage win yet. Is that right? He's got the TT win, but there's something... There's quite a lot of prestige in doing that, isn't there? In throwing your hands in the air after a real kind of symbolic stage win. And I think for Vingegaard, I think the final mountain stage on Saturday is gonna, you know, he'll still want to win, even though this Tour is basically already won.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, I was at the UAE Team Emirates bus at the finish, and Machin Fernandez, who, even in the most difficult circumstances, is kind of all smiles and happy to answer questions. He had no real answers. And, this is what he said at the finish. I know it's very early, but have you any indication what's wrong with today? Did you have the impression this morning that he wasn't quite right?
But the impression of yesterday is actually, after all, 1 minute 38 is a lot of the time. Internal is the super complicated after 1 minute 38, not only for the time, and for the gap, and only for the really good dash. For this is the, obviously today is the key fighting for the, maybe is the bad day of Jonas, and obviously is the good day of Jonas and bad day of Tadej. Is the don't good feeling in the second climb, and after is the plan is the maybe attack, and after is the maintain the pace, and don't pull for maintaining the position, and in the moment of the of this one level more of the pace, obviously Tadej is crass.
So Fernandez basically also said that they want to make sure they get that second and third place on the podium. That's the best they can do now, really, with Pogacar and Yates. What about Jumbo-Visma then? Because when we were at the service station earlier on, Richard, we saw the front page of L'Équipe, and the headline was Une Autre Planète, which to me just brought back echoes of Sur Une Autre Planète, which was the headline that L'Équipe ran the day after Lance Armstrong blitzed everybody on the climb to Sestriere in the 1999 Tour de France. And I think in some of the writing there's also been some scepticism. One of the other French papers, Aujourd'hui, I think it was, the headline was basically, how did he do it? And there is this scepticism, cynicism that swirls around the yellow jersey, and now that the gap is 7:35, it will be very interesting to see what the French papers in particular make of it tomorrow.
That's right, and it's amazing coming from the United Kingdom, where we don't quite have the same, a newspaper or a publication doesn't quite have the same influence over the sort of zeitgeist and the talking points and the discussion in the way that L'Équipe does with the Tour de France. And the very fact that they put that headline there sort of sets the tone, really, for a lot of the debate. We haven't seen tomorrow morning's papers yet, but it will be really fascinating to see how they digest what Vingegaard did again today, because as much as he'd put himself in a winning position after the time trial, I mean, his performance today was equally impressive. I mean, he wasn't actually that far away from Felix Gall and Simon Yates by the end there, which is speaks for itself, really. He was the same rider that we saw yesterday again today.
Indeed. At the bus, I spoke to Jumbo-Visma's team manager, Arthur van Dongen, and I asked him what he'd made of L'Equipe's front page headline this morning.
Yeah, that's the Tour de France. Eh? We know Jonas very well, and we know what we do. Yeah, and that's the Tour de France, and that's up to them. It is what it is, but it's up to them.
Is it slightly disappointing when you put together such a consistent race, a dominant performance, a dominant time trial, and then that's the kind of coverage that you see?
Oh, what I mentioned already, it's the Tour de France, yeah? And we are prepared for that. It's every year the same, yeah? But it is what it is. And we stay how we work, yeah? And we know Jonas, no doubt.
Well, I think what Arthur van Dongen said there, it's the Tour de France. This scepticism does swirl around the yellow jersey, particularly when the winning margin is significant or the performance is dominant. And I suppose we have all kind of seen these performances before, and they have not stood up to scrutiny. Lance Armstrong, of course, but then there have been question marks about Bradley Wiggins with the Triumph Cinelone and the TUEs, Chris Froome and the TUEs. The yellow jersey is always, it always comes with question marks, and the suspicion ramps up. And I suppose what I would say, having seen today's performances, is that, as you say, Richard, Vingegaard rode as strongly today as he did yesterday. Pogacar has clearly unravelled pretty spectacularly in the last 36 hours, and is no longer in contention. But until that point, they were both incredibly well matched and well clear of the others in the GC battle. And I suppose my question would be, well, if Vingegaard is now under intense suspicion or scepticism, then his performances in the first 2 weeks were consistent with his performances in the last 2 days, I think, more or less. I mean, these two riders are the outliers in the Tour de France, which itself is the outlier in professional cycling. And then when the outliers produce performances that are extraordinary, suddenly we want them to appear completely human and completely fallible. And we've seen Pogacar fallible, and we haven't seen any cracks in Vingegaard's armour. But then when you think back a couple of weeks, when Pogacar had him slightly on the ropes, there were chinks there.
It's really interesting to note, like you said, Lionel, that there's always that sort of, it's lurking in the background, that question, isn't it? At any point, it's just below the surface. But throughout this tour, that question of whether we can believe what we're seeing hasn't really come to the fore until Vingegaard put nearly 2 minutes into Pogacar in the time trial. And I wonder, we'll never know, but had it been much more closely matched on the time trial and again today, would we be having this discussion? Would L'Equipe have put that front page? It would have taken nothing away from Vingegaard's performances, but there is something about that sort of the standout nature of it, the difference in that's been shown between Vingegaard and Pogacar now, which has brought those questions on Vingegaard. And
yeah, I think it comes up when the race is suddenly over and everyone feels that slight deflation. I mean, I'm not sort of doing a corrections corner on you here, but you said put nearly 2 minutes into Pogacar in the time trial. It was 1:38, which is actually quite a long way off 2 minutes. And I think we sort of shorthand term quite a lot of our discussions around how the racing unfolds and exaggerate almost in our own minds what happened. Yes, it was an absolute hammering, and the gap to Wout van Aert, 2:51, it was a dominant performance. I suppose what I would say is that we're on a sticky ground watching an endurance sport like the Tour de France if it's going to be kind of ruled by a sort of performance-based suspicion. Somebody has to win. There's nothing to say that somebody can't be significantly better than the second best athlete. But I think the problem cycling has and continues to have is that there is this legacy. It really isn't that long ago that riders were being kicked out of the Tour de France left, right and centre. You mentioned Lance Armstrong and the seven asterisks. That's not all that long ago. He he raced up here in 2000 and 2005, you know, at Courchevel. So there's this all this history that's sort of bound up with the Tour de France, and there's never going to be a clean break. There's never been a clean break. I suppose the other point I'd make is that we're in a strange era of all still waters on the doping front. You know, if you think back even to the Sky years, there were, you know, there were links to doctors or, you know, well, as we found with the TUEs, you know, there's kind of no noise in the forest, is there? And I suppose it's a little bit like that analogy, which I'm going to mangle. But if a tree falls in the woods and no one's there to hear it, has the tree fallen over? And I think there's a little kind of element of that to the way we look at doping in cycling now. I'm not going to say that the sport is clean, because I don't think there's any way that any of us can say that. But I also think that there is so little noise around doping in professional cycling at the moment. There's so few kind of connections other than the kind of the historical connections. You could look at the team staff on some of the team staff on UAE Team Emirates and look back at their careers and their connections to riders who've tested positive. I mean, let's face it, Maxime Fernandez was the boss of the Saunier Duval team of Leonardo Piepoli and Ricardo Rico in the 2008 Tour de France. And there are staff members in lots of teams who will have a history. But I think there's a certain kind of opaqueness about what is going on at the moment. We kind of just don't know.
And all we have to go on is the evidence of performance, like you said, which in a race like, well, in any race, it's a sport which is looking for the real outliers in the population who are capable of putting in these performances, which seem like, in the L'Equipe's words, from another planet. And cycling hasn't yet got to that point, I don't think, where the peloton is uniformly freaky. For what, you know, to carry on. I feel like I'm being a little bit rude here to the peloton, but
it's a sport of outliers, and this is an event for those outliers. I guess that's the big problem, isn't it? We kind of crave closeness, I think, more than we crave excellence. I think if the sort of public reaction is to you know, that's the sense I get. I certainly feel that. You know, there was that deflation last night that the tour is over when we'd seen this fantastic battle. It is so close, so beautifully poised. Yeah. And it could have been decided by seconds, but it hasn't been.
And I think as well, this is sort of evident in a sense to us here. You know, we've been sort of torpedoed slightly by first Robbie Williams covers and now by biting insects. I'm trying to land on the microphone here. The Tour de France doesn't take place in a bubble. It takes place in the real world. We were stuck behind the UAE team bus coming down in the evacuation off Courchevel today. I mean, there are real world conditions that we don't see and that we don't really consider when we think about these performances, which aren't there to excuse performances. We can't say that Pogacar had a bad day because he had a bad bus ride or because he didn't sleep very well in the Compagnie hotel because the air conditioning didn't work. But it's important to remember that this takes place over a very long period of time, and as much as they are outliers, they are human. Mm. And they're quite young men really as well, and they're all vulnerable to certain things, and that's, you know, when you have to take that into account as well.
I think I'll seek out Alex Roos over the next day or two. He's the writer, the chief cycling writer for L'Equipe, and he was not responsible for the headline on the front page of L'Equipe. That would be staff in the office, of course, but it would be interesting to get his perspective on what he's made of the last 2 days of racing. And, well, he was the subject of a Kilometre Zero. He spoke very well about his own work, and it would be interesting to hear his point of view. Now, somebody else who's in the thick of the action today was our very good friend, Seb Piquet.
This is Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, sitting at the back of the bag.
Bonjour, bonjour from Courchevel. What a day. I have said it before, I will say it again. Something has changed on the Tour de France. Never have I seen so many spectators on the side of the road. I don't know why, I don't know if there is a reason, but ever since we started in Basque Country, going through the Pyrenees, Massif Central, now in the Alps, and today for the Queen's Stage, I have never seen so many people on the side of the road. And sadly, they're not all very disciplined. What happened today? Well, we were going up to Le Col de la Lose behind the yellow jersey, Jonas Vingegaard, who was actually on his own. And suddenly we saw a red car, a commissaire car, in front of us, stopped, blocked, probably because of motorbikes being blocked in front of them. And it was absolutely chaotic. Riders were coming from behind. They couldn't go through. Vingegaard couldn't go through. Thankfully, it had no consequence on the standings. But it's a bit worrying for the editions to come, and I'm afraid that things will need to be done. I don't know what. I'm not a specialist. I don't know if it's barriers. I don't know if it's preventing people to go, or too many people to go to some of the climbs. I mean, it's a free sport. It has to remain a free sport. It's great to have spectators, but something really has to be done because we will have a problem one day. The other issue is also the alcohol. I mean, the fans that we saw on the side of the road were sometimes not completely normal, probably due to alcohol. They are not necessarily cycling fans. They don't necessarily know how a race goes. They don't necessarily know that behind a rider there are cars, there are motorbikes, there are other riders. So yeah, it was pretty chaotic. And I will certainly remember this Queen stage for a very long time.
Just quickly, Richard, that incident with the car that got stopped and then Vingegaard, and I think by that stage it was Kelderman, wasn't it, trying to get past. The road was completely blocked. The motorbikes were stalled, couldn't get going again. The crowd at all, filled the road. As Seb says there, it's getting to a point where the crowds are so significant on the climbs that it's beginning to impact the race, and maybe something will have to be done in future years to just ensure that the riders have enough space to race on the roads.
I didn't quite make it up to the climb of the Col de la Lose, but we're seeing it time and time again, aren't we? We were talking about this the other night, actually, once we'd finished recording, but there's a sense that cycling is sort of owned by the public. It's not owned by, the Tour de France is run and owned by ASO, but the public has a real significant stake in any cycling event. And so the notion of limiting access to go and watch that is actually kind of a bit of a taboo, really. It's a very difficult thing to even consider, and to even think of charging people to go up and see a bike race is even worse. I mean, that's one of cycling's great strengths. So I think, I'm sure this is a topic we'll return to, but it's something that organisers and commissaires and UCI are going to have to tread very carefully around this. It's not going to be an easy issue to solve.
Well, talking of safety, Richard, you went up to the part of the descent over the top of the Col de la Lose where they had constructed some airbeds on a tight corner to, well, protect the riders and stop them from, presumably, from going over the edge if they got the corner wrong.
That's right. I met a chap called Dominique who had installed the air pads, as they are, they have a name. They are basically giant airbeds, sort of 2 meters tall by about 10 long. And there are 5 of them in a line on a really nasty corner, actually. Very steep drop off into it, not much sight line coming into it, narrow road, sharp turn. The organisers and Dominique, this chap who works for a company that manages safety in skiing competitions normally, ASO, and he had basically discussed and analysed the climb and identified this as the most dangerous corner on that descent. So this is the first time they've been put in a bike race. And the idea is that if a rider doesn't make that turn, instead of carrying on at that speed into what was sort of a gravelly lay-by area and off into Alpine Meadow, they go into these air pads, which are designed to deflate on impact. They have valves which are quite sensitive to shock and they're quite softly inflated. So the idea is a rider goes into them, becomes sort of enveloped by the airbed, and then it falls over and keeps them safe. It doesn't look like, it's not a sort of entirely comfortable procedure, but it's there to stop serious injury or worse. And
better than the alternative.
Absolutely. And Well, whether we'll see this in more cycling events, I don't know. They do look very easy to install. They're just a sort of modified leaf blower and to inflate them. And Dominique just had a pickup truck, so yeah, quite low cost, easy, and presumably effective, but measure. But let's hope they're never tested in competition.
And they've come over from alpine skiing.
That's right, yeah, skiing and MotoGP, motorcycle racing on circuits is where they've been used before. So it's sort of proof of they've been proved in other sports, so it's not complete unproven technology there.
It's never too late for the 1101 cappuccino. Get regular updates from the Cycling Podcast in your email inbox or the Substack app during the Tour de France. Go to thecyclingpodcast.substack.com to sign up.
L'étape de demain, le dîner d'hier. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Well, yesterday's dinner was an absolute delight, wasn't it? It was very un-Tour de France-like. We came down to Sallanches and Lizzie Banks had found a takeaway sushi place and we ordered our sushi and we sat in a little square at some tables that belonged to a cafe that had closed, but we pulled a seat up and ate our sushi. I ordered the sort of set menu, which were called the calories.
I was going to say, are you going to admit to the listeners?
It was a huge quantity of sushi and I didn't manage to get through it all, but it was absolutely delicious. And in fact, after sort of 2 weeks on the tour with eating lots of sort of meat in brown sauce, which, you know, is nice, but it does become a bit wearing to have, ramen 2 nights ago and then sushi last night, I feel like a new man.
I'm itching for that. Cassoulet or...
Oh, no, that's the mosquitoes, Richard. some sad news for the balloon, Lion Bernie, bought for me to celebrate my birthday on the opening day of the tour way back in Bilbao. I'd had hope to get balloon Lion Bernie home. It's a big lion face, a bit like one of the Credit Lyonnais lions that UAE Team Emirates have in the window of their bus for Adam Yates's yellow jerseys early in the tour. Big smiley lion. And unfortunately, he didn't make it today. I opened the door of the Cycling Podcast broom wagon. I think the high altitude, it was so firm. You know, you would expect over a couple of weeks for a sort of birthday party balloon to deflate a bit, but it hadn't deflated at all, and it felt so firm. And as soon as I opened the door, it just burst.
I mean, anything can happen, can't it? You just never know. In the third week of a tour, you can be so close to making it to Paris, and exactly, then it just all disappears like that. Exactly. Happened to Lion.
What is on the menu for tomorrow? Because it's, looks on paper like it might be a sprint stage, but that all depends on who's going to go in the break and who is prepared to chase the break. It's a little bit lumpy. Leaves from Moutier, goes to Bourg-en-Bresse, the home of the very fine Poulet de Bresse, the chicken. Maybe we'll have some chicken in brown sauce tomorrow night, Richard. Matt Heyman of Jayco Alula said he's fed up with second places and they really hope that it will be a sprint tomorrow. Dylan Groenewegen is their man, of course. He had one of those second places in Moulin, I think it was, earlier in the tour. Still looking for that first win for Jayco Alula, so they will certainly chase. But having lost Phil Bauhaus today, the sprint field is thinning out a little bit. And it remains to be seen how well Jasper Philipsen has got through the mountains and whether Alpecin de Koenig have the fight for that chase. Who are we looking at other than Philipsen? Mads Pedersen, Brian Cockar, Jordi Meus, Biniam Gamai, Groenewegen. The sprint field has thinned out a fair bit. And, depending on how things go, it could be a sprint tomorrow. Could perhaps even be a sprint on Friday. And then almost certainly a sprint on the Champs-Élysées. So Philipsen might well be looking at 5, 6, 7 stage wins.
Which, for a tour that was light on sprint stages, as was the tour coming into it, he's, And I think the thing with Philipsen as well is he hasn't won those stages and got where he's got in the green jersey competition because other sprinters have disappeared. He's looked great in the mountains and he's looked like the fastest sprinter here. So it will be quite interesting to see how he comes out of these last few days. I mean, I was up at the finish line in the Altiport and once the sort of GC contenders and breakaway riders come through, you then see the bigger riders, the lead out men, the kind of baroudeurs, and then the sprinters come through and they all just look universally very tired. it's not been an easy few days, has it, for them? And even just the time trial, making the time cut yesterday. So that's to take into account as well, how they've come through these last few days. But I think Philipsen on previous form has been pretty comfortable as far as you can be for a sprinter. So, yeah.
Well, we shall see tomorrow. We'll be in Bourg-en-Bresse this time tomorrow. Hopefully not surrounded by a peloton of mosquitoes. We need to go and have something to eat. It might be cheesy here in the Alps, mightn't it?
But, cheesy sushi.
Cheesy sushi. No, I don't think that's such a thing. But until tomorrow, Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lionel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.